Reported homicides are down in Cleveland compared to last year, according to a new report. In fact, more than 200 cities nationwide, including Miami, Boston, and Philadelphia, saw major drops over last year, continuing a downward trend across the country for many cities that saw a major spike in homicides during the pandemic. This hour, we'll take a deeper look at these statistics and see why the number of reported homicides are trending down, and we'll compare it to other crime rates in the city. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk to a criminal justice reporter, a gun violence expert, and someone who works in neighborhoods to support victims of violence in Cleveland. Later, a conversation with a grief counselor about the traumatic impact of the pandemic. And finally, a conversation with a Cranes Cleveland business 8 over 80 honoree. Those conversations are coming up. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us. Reported homicides are down in major cities across the country as compared to last year, according to a new report from the criminal justice consulting firm AH Datalytics. It looked at more than 200 cities, including Cleveland, Miami, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and others, that saw major drops in the last year, continuing a downward trend cities have seen since a peak of homicides during the pandemic in 2020. According to Cleveland police data, there was a drop of homicides of 28% from 2023 to 2024 through mid-April. That's a total of 31 homicides this year compared to 43 in both 2023 and 2022. Now, to start today's show, we're going to look more closely at what these numbers mean, and then we're going to look beyond the numbers. Can the dip be attributed to anything? Better policing, policy, community intervention programs? And how do these homicide numbers compare to other crime rates? And how does it feel for people working on the ground? Joining me in studio to discuss this is Matt Richman, IdeaStream's criminal justice reporter. Matt, thanks for coming in.
Morning, Jenny.
Good morning. Also with us in person is Maisha Watkins with the Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance. They've been at the forefront of efforts to reduce violence in the city since 2015. Maisha, so glad to have you.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
And finally, by phone, we have Dr. Wendy Regacy, professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of South Carolina. Wendy, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks very much for having me.
Later in the show, we're going to hear an author and grief counselor discuss the grieving many of us still have to do in the years following the pandemic. And finally, we'll meet an inspiring 95-year-old who is fighting to keep the stories of freedom seekers alive in Ohio. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903. You can email us, soi@ideastream.org, or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Wendy, what have you found in your research about what might have led to this national downward trend, and how significant do you think it actually is?
The decline we're seeing now is definitely significant after, you know, I would say basically 3 years of particularly high and concerning levels of homicides in a lot of U.S. cities, including many of the largest cities. We are really starting to see beginning a little bit in 2023, where, across the board nationally, we started to see a decline in violent crime in general, as well as in homicides specifically. And that decline that began last year seems to be continuing on in 2024. We certainly think that there are several things that are contributing to this decline. And of course, the research is ongoing because, as we know, particularly when we're trying to look nationally at homicide statistics, national data come out well after the years of interest have passed. And so, you know, for a full year of 2024 data, it could be 2026 by the time those data nationally are available for analysis. But, looking sort of at the city-specific level data that are available earlier, it seems like a lot of the societal disruptions that the pandemic caused, including, all of the closures of schools and courts and social services, You know, the issues we had with community programs trying to operate during the pandemic, you know, many of these things, now that the pandemic is largely passed, many of these programs have since returned, and we can see that they, you know, really make a difference. We also see that the high levels of stress that really impacted, you know, families and communities during the pandemic, at least some of this has started to subside as well.
All right. Matt, what is the perspective of the Cleveland Police Department when it comes to specifically these homicides, why there was a spike around the pandemic years, and if they're attributing any sort of success or, you know, even a increment of positive news when it comes to homicide rate decline, are they attributing it to anything?
You heard a lot of things back then that there were issues with witnesses reporting what they had seen. There were issues with staff shortages. There were issues with kind of being able to have enough people out on any shift to respond to calls for services. And then there was sort of a general kind of problem with morale in the department that that between, you know, a feeling that Cleveland police were underpaid and that there was a national sort of mood against police because this was at the time of George Floyd protests.
Sure.
And, you know, I think first thing, when you look closely at the numbers, the idea that the homicide rate or the number of homicides in a year in Cleveland is connected to the number of police that are out on patrol, is there's no evidence. You know, the number of police on patrol has been declining since the spike in homicides in 2020, where it got up to like 174. Each year, the number of officers on patrol has declined, and each year, the number of homicides has declined. So, you know, I just want to be clear about that. There's no connection in the numbers there. I think, you know, one thing that you know, I mean, it's hard to kind of say, you know, how police are doing their job, whether that the morale issues have been fully addressed. I mean, there was a large raise given by the city of Cleveland last year, and I'm sure that helped. You can see in the numbers, you know, if you go back to 2018 and 2019, the city keeps track of all its uses of force. And this is any time, you know, it could be as simple as an officer pointing their firearm at someone. That requires a use of force report. And they started reporting those and then, you know, the more serious ones. And any time a person is resisting arrest and needs to be, you know, controlled in a physical way, all the way up to use of deadly force, they have to report all those. And you can see in 2018 when they first started with this expanded reporting, it was at like 335 uses of force. And in 2020, it dipped to 260, and it kept going down. 2021, 2022 got down like in the hundreds. And then last year, you saw it starting to climb back up. And that is, you know, one indication in the numbers that officers are kind of out being more proactive again. And that might be partly an indication that sort of there's an improvement in morale.
Got it. Maisha, so we talk about this national drop in only homicide rates, and then specifically we talk about a drop in homicides of 28% between 2023 to 2024 through mid-April. What is your experience as someone who is on the ground level, every day working with people in Cleveland neighborhoods and specifically trying to support victims of violence? Does this track with you?
Absolutely. Really excited that for the first time in our history, we've seen a national drop in gun violence and homicides. And I would like to say that partially this can be because we have the resources and support at the federal level. The Biden-Harris administration have done a really great job establishing the first ever White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, where they're showing up in communities and they're supporting organizations similar to Cleveland Peacemakers. So I think that when you acknowledge all of the things that can contribute to the reduction of gun violence, it's a shared messaging. It's having champions at every state of government. It's putting resources back into communities that are the most impacted by gun violence. But it's also to acknowledge that gun violence has not been funded for research in the past 30 years. So now we're able to see what are really the underlying issues that are leading to gun violence and community gun violence, fatal and non-fatal shootings. I think as it relates to the work that I see on the ground, working with victims and perpetrators and survivors of gun violence, it's hard because as headlines are seeing a decrease, communities are hearing gunshots often. They're losing their peers. They're losing their loved ones. They're losing their family members. And sometimes when you're in the thick of it, headlines are important to those who get the opportunity to read it, but it's disempowering to communities that continue to be impacted by gun violence every single day, where it seems like there's a 20% decrease in a city, but in communities, they're still suffering from the direct impacts of gun violence every single day. So I'm excited when I see the headlines, but I'm still heartbroken when I'm in community, when my team are meeting at bedside, they're meeting in courts, they're being at the schools, finding firearms, hidden behind houses and cars. So I think it's twofold for me. Like every day working in gun violence prevention, it seems like one shot fired is too much, one life lost is too much. So I'm inspired by the decrease that's national and both local, but in communities, the persisting problem of being impacted by gun violence indirectly or directly is a consistent fight for my team.
And we had a phone call prior to our conversation now, and you were saying you're getting texts all the time about gun violence and violence in various forms.
Absolutely. My team and I are alerted every time someone is shot. We are deployed to both level one trauma hospitals and the community to be able to support patients at bedside and their family and to be able to do crowd control, conflict mediation, and support the community during that active scene. So it seems like it's continuous. And every shooting doesn't make the headline. So a lot of people may think that it's not happening as much, but we are alerted often.
Not everything's reported.
Absolutely.
In an official way.
Absolutely.
Wendy, what have you found at the local level about not just homicides, but other types of violent crimes, including felonious assaults? How is this trend affected by crimes involving a firearm in comparison to other types of weapons?
Well, I mean, we know not just in Cleveland, but in many urban areas across the U.S. that the rates of increase that we saw in homicides have been very much driven by gun violence. And as Maisha mentions, there's also still a lot of non-fatal gun violence occurring as well. We also know that with some more recent research that's been done that some of the increases that we've seen across the cities are really driven, even though we've seen it sort of across different types of homicides, the increases really seem to be largest for homicides and non-fatal violence involving acquaintances and strangers. And that's where the work of organizations like Maisha's, Cleveland Peacemakers, their work is so critical to how things play out in local communities. I think, you know, her points about the fact that we can see these national declines and feel some optimism behind them shouldn't overshadow the fact that there are still communities experiencing very high levels of gun violence. And it's also really important to sort of to keep the context of the decline in perspective. So while rates did go down in 2023 and appeared at least to be going down in 2024, mind you, we're looking at the first quarter of 2024 data.
Right.
And we know that violent crimes tend to be highest in the summer, right? So we really want to be watching for like what's going to happen in the next 4 months. But keeping it in perspective, I mean, even as the rates decline right now, you know, it really looks like we're trending back towards sort of pre-pandemic levels. But those pre-pandemic levels were high relative to what we saw like at the turn of the century, for example. So homicide rates through the 2000s and really almost up to about 2014 were quite low and under 4.5 per 100,000. Even the declines we're seeing now, we're still at like 6 per 100,000, which when you're like talking about the actual counts of how many lives are lost, like that we're still in high numbers. So it may be coming down, but we're not back to the days that we saw at the turn of the century, where homicide rates were getting close to being back to what we saw in the early 1960s before they really took off across the nation.
I am talking to Dr. Wendy Regacy with the University of Southern South Carolina, Maisha Watkins with Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance, and Matt Richman, our own criminal justice reporter, about a drop in homicide rates in major cities across the country, including Cleveland, but looking beyond those numbers to see what's really happening on the ground in our region. Matt, I wanted to ask you, you found the numbers from the 2nd Police District were largely contributing to the drop in Cleveland's homicide rate. Tell us the area that the 2nd Police District covers, and give us a little more context about what might be happening there.
That's part of the Near West Side. It's a Tremont, Clark Fulton, Stockyards, Detroit Shoreway. This is just for January of 2024 through April 20th of 2024. And this year, there were three homicides during that period. Last year, there were 12. And that almost entirely accounts for the difference between this year and last year up to this point. And then also there were a lot of shootings too there, and the kind of increase in shootings last year compared to this year basically accounts for the difference last year. And I just thought that was noteworthy, and it's worth, and I hope Maisha could talk about this a little bit. It very often is, specific issues as opposed to like a general kind of mood, that there's just something specific going on.
So are you talking about a dynamic between gangs or, specific incidents happening, that kind of tension?
This is something that I hope Maisha could talk about. But yeah, it is usually like, somebody in one neighborhood has a problem with somebody, an issue in another neighborhood, and they start, having incidents back and forth. And that's how shootings happen.
Maisha, do you want to add context to that?
Yeah, I would like to say a lot of the violence that we've seen maybe like 10 years ago, a lot of people thought that the issue was due to gang violence. What we're starting to see across the country is that interpersonal conflict is accounting for a large part of the community violence that we're seeing. And similar to what you shared, is very territorial, is conflict that may have started on social media that is spilling out into the community or classroom, mm-hmm. where people are now saying, if you do something to me, the easiest way to solve my problem, if I have access to it, is with a firearm or a gun. And that is not how we're supposed to handle conflict. Mm-hmm. So how do we educate young people, and when we think about gun violence, the average shooter is age 27. So not just putting the onus on young people to figure out, but to the older young adult to say, what can we do to both manage our conflict before it turns fatal? And that's the work of Cleveland Peacemakers, that we do life-saving interventions that interrupt violence at a community level that may stop law enforcement from having to respond. But I think one of your points to a reduction in community is all about the investments that's put into communities by council people in the city that is able to create a community and a culture where there's alternatives to violence. If you think about the Tremont area, there may be different alternatives, resources, and projects or programs that are going on that's different from a Ward 5 or inner city community where violence seems to be the only option, although we know that that's not true. So how do we promote safety and healing in communities that oftentimes see and hear about gun violence more often, and create resources that speaks to that, so that we can too see a decline in communities that are constantly impacted by violence, and build up the community, the built and lived environment for those people in community.
I want to talk about the youth and your focus on what you see as concerning, behaviors or trends when it comes to the young people in Cleveland and them kind of gravitating more towards violence as the next course of action.
Yeah, I think it's It's a crazy thought, because even if I try to go back as far into my childhood, which seems like forever ago, and think about when I was the most upset, what would I do? And the most that I would have done when I was a younger person was probably use words that I wasn't supposed to use to people who upset me. What we're seeing now in trends is that the accessibility to firearms allow somebody first thought to be, I'm going to shoot you, or I'm going to kill you, or I have a gun. And having to take that information as truth, because the accessibility to firearms for anybody in our country is too great, whether it's parents that doesn't have safe storage, or young people, or people buying illegal guns off social media or community, that you have to really take that as a serious threat. I think with young people is that the accessibility to make a firearm that is not even real through ghost guns and zombie guns, and then even Glock creating this real mimic of a toy gun, is a problem. Because even if it's not a real gun, if I'm being bullied and I have access to a toy gun, I can show it, I can post a picture of it, and someone can perceive that it's real. But a toy, like a gun, is not a toy. And one bullet can change the life of a person and a community. So I think young people just need to understand that there are other ways to solve problems outside of something fatal or non-fatal. We can get mediation. We can bring in a third party. We can talk about our parents. We can include our schools. We can include our community members. But we have to let young people know that there are alternatives to violence. And if you take time, you can really figure it out to live the life where you can be both alive and free. But you have to remove the concept of even wanting to use a firearm.
All right. We are running out of time. We only have a couple of minutes. Michael wrote in and asked if the presence on the streets of the members of the New Era Cleveland might have a role in the drop of violence. Do any of you have familiarity
yes.
with Maisha?
I love New Era Cleveland. Chairman Fahim and Austria are doing great work. They do these community events where they're patrolling a certain block of the community at times where violence is high, and they engage with community residents by loving on them, giving resources to them, even staying at the bus stop with someone until their bus come, because they're afraid that they may get hurt or harmed. But their thought process is really showing up in communities, providing resources, and being authentic, right? The communities that are impacted the most are Black and brown communities, and the people of New Era Cleveland are Black and brown individuals. And they just continue to show up with resources or not, using their lived and shared experience to interrupt violence, to help find young people who are missing, to advocate for Black and brown people who are being mistreated by businesses in their communities. So they're doing a great work. And I like to believe that anybody that is doing community work has contributed to the reduction in violence. And it's not just one person or one organization, not one system or one program, but it's all of us collectively showing up, because one life lost is too many.
All right. So Dr. Wendy Regassi, professor of criminology and criminal justice at the university. You did, and we've run out of time. So I appreciate you participating in the conversation. I appreciate Maisha Watkins with the Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance, and of course, Matt Richmond, criminal justice reporter here at Ideas Room. Thank you all for participating in this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Time now for a quick break. When we return, we'll hear an author discuss the need to properly mourn the pandemic we all experienced more than 4 years ago. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for staying with us. Last month marked the four-year anniversary of the declaration of the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as when lockdowns began, when we started to see deaths spike across the planet. Today, vaccines are widespread. COVID has reached endemic status, and life has in many ways returned to normal. But grief counselor Claire Bidwell-Smith warns that as a society, we've never really given ourselves the opportunity to grieve and deal with the trauma of the pandemic. She says it's not just grief from losing loved ones, but the loss of uncertainty, security, and the world continuity to speed by as we mourn. Smith's new book is called Conscious Grieving, a transformative approach to healing from loss. She hopes it can act as a roadmap for people continuing to deal with the impact of the pandemic. She recently spoke with IdeaStream coordinating producer Drew Mazzius.
Claire Bidwell-Smith, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire, this book comes out around the four-year anniversary of the pandemic lockdown and all of our lives really changing forever. We'll really dig into grief and the pandemic a little bit later, but first, something on you. What kind of work do you do as a grief counselor, and what's your background there?
I have been a therapist specializing in grief for almost two decades. I came into this work after going through the really personal losses of both of my parents at a young age. I was 14 when they both got cancer at the same time. My mom died when I was 18 and my dad when I was 25. So I entered into young adulthood with a lot of grief and not a lot of family. Eventually, I ended up working in hospice for a period of time as a grief therapist, and now I've been in private practice for a long time.
There are several types of grief described in this book, one of which being collective grief. How do you see society wrestling with our collective grief 4 years later? We're looking at more than 1 million deaths here in the U.S. due to COVID. How do we cope with that?
You know, I think we're carrying a lot more grief than we realize. There was a period of time during the pandemic early on when it seemed like we were making some cultural shifts around our awareness of grief. We were really recognizing all the different kinds of things we can grieve. Obviously, there were so many people dying, but we were also grieving for our ways of life and safety and certainty and kids being home from school and weddings being canceled. There was so much to grieve. And there was a while there where we were really kind of talking about it more and sharing about it. And it seems now that we've, you know, we're approaching this 4 year mark that we've really kind of let it go a little bit and stopped recognizing how much grief that we really might be still carrying. And I think it's partly our culture, you know, we've never been too great about talking about grief and loss and making space for it. And so it's kind of easy to put it away and pretend like it's not there, but I'm seeing it spill out in anxiety. You know, when we're not allowing space for grief, it often will find some other way to come out. And usually it's anxiety or anger, irritability.
Mm-hmm. I know reading through this book, anger and anxiety are two big emotions that you write about stemming from grief. It's interesting when you talk about America and not allowing ourselves time to grieve. What do you think about our culture and that allowance of just space to grieve?
Yeah, we're getting better for sure. And I think our younger generations especially are really recognizing the importance of mental health and talking about their feelings and experiences. But I think you're right about the short period of time that we're allowing ourselves. I mean, if you even just look at bereavement leave and you lose someone major like a spouse or a child and you still only get a few days off of work, the message that that sends to someone who is grieving is a message that you should be getting on with things quicker than really we're capable of doing.
And there's not a lot of space for follow-up. It's not allowed to be, you know, maybe a long process.
That's right. You know, the first few weeks or months of a big loss, there's so much stuff that happens that requires a lot of busy work. Maybe there's memorial or funerals to plan. There's paperwork. There's all kinds of things that happen. And sometimes some of that really deep grief doesn't set in for a few months. And that's often at the same time when people have really dropped away.
In the midst of the pandemic, while so many individuals were dying, we were also social distancing, people facing loneliness and isolation while also dealing with grief and loss. What were your observations about the combinations of those two issues that we saw?
I think that was really hard on people. I mean, we were really stripped of our rituals, which are so important in grief. We weren't able to sit Shiva or have memorials. You know, we were doing these online Zoom funerals, and I think that community is really important in grief. I think we need to be able to come together, reflect and share with each other and support each other. We've seen such a proliferation of online connectivity and there's a lot of benefits to it. And I'm still seeing tons of clients on Zoom because they don't want to go back to in person just out of convenience. So I think there's been some helpful strides in that area. But I think it was so hard for so many people to feel so alone in their grief process because it's already lonely. It's already a lonely process.
You write a bit about holidays and anniversaries in this book, this coming out around the 4 year mark of the pandemic lockdown. What would be your advice for people who are marking an anniversary of someone who might not be with us anymore? You know, a birthday, maybe a wedding, or even just looking at the holiday season?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important, first of all, to acknowledge that these dates and anniversaries can be really hard. They can bring up so many emotions, so much sorrow or wistfulness. just to let yourself have permission to recognize that is really important. And then I think sometimes we feel like maybe we're supposed to do something really big in commemoration or as a way to kind of mark the day, but you can do something small, like simply light a little candle and have a moment of reflection or share a story about your person with someone in your family, you know, just talking about people, saying their names, sharing those stories and memories is really important. We can also do much bigger things. You know, my dad was a pilot in the war, and on his 10-year death anniversary, I took a small plane lesson, and it was really, really cool. I felt very close to him, like sitting in the cockpit of this little airplane. So there's all kinds of ways we can kind of connect and honor the people that we love.
What about different ages of people? The pandemic impacted all of these different generations. Have you and your peers looked at how, say, teenagers have dealt with trauma versus people in their 50s or 60s?
Yeah, again, it's, you know, our culture is changing so much that these younger generations almost have an easier time of recognizing some of their feelings and the importance of honoring them. They also have so many more resources than we did when we were growing up. And I think that some of us in our older generations are still struggling to feel like we can make space for grief or know what to do with it because we haven't had a lot of role models for it. So you might see someone in their 50s or 60s struggling more than someone in their younger years, which is interesting.
And tying this back to something you said earlier, with anger and anxiety being two of those big byproducts of grief, are you seeing how those two feelings are, you know, maybe playing out among different age groups or populations?
Anxiety is just continuing to be on the rise. And, you know, for so many reasons, there's, I think, social media and just online technology is just presenting so much information all the time. You know, we're picking up our phones before we're even out of bed in the morning. And when we do that, we're just downloading copious amounts of information without really taking time to process much. So I think there's that reason, plus so many world events happening. I mean, the pandemic thrust us into a state of a lot of uncertainty. You know, we were all kind of going along thinking we knew what our lives were like or planning ahead for the future. And then when that was taken away, it's very abrupt and startling. And I think there remains some vestiges of, you know, what's coming next. Anxiety is really common response to loss because our whole world can change in an instant when we lose someone we love, whether it's expected or not. So much of the landscape of our life changes when we go through a big loss, and that can feel really disorienting, and you can feel kind of unsafe in your life. You're not sure what to expect next. You might be reckoning with your own mortality. You might be, you know, really just experiencing anxiety about who you're going to be now after this person is gone. So we're definitely seeing so much more anxiety. And I think one of the things we could really do to work on it is to just stop and reflect more, you know, really kind of think about what's coming up for us. What has a world event or the pandemic or a loss, what has that taught you about yourself? Or how has that changed your worldview? And how can you support yourself in terms of how your identity might be shifting or the ways that you think about your life and the world? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And you're a professional here with plenty in your toolbox. And what about the layperson who might want to come to the assistance of someone who's grieving, maybe a coworker or a friend who's lost someone? Is there a right way for us to approach a situation as a non-professional when we want to help?
Yeah, I think reaching out, letting people know that you're here. I think people get really nervous to say the wrong thing, but there's not always a right thing to say to someone who's struggling and going through grief. I think just showing up and letting them know that you're there for them. You can even tell them, I'm not sure what to say. But you know, grief takes its own timeline, and we can't always predict how we're going to be feeling and how long it might take to move through a loss. And so really kind of giving people a little bit more permission to grieve longer than we usually do, I think is really important.
Mm. How do you take care of yourself in your line of work? And I ask that because so many people gave so much of themselves during the pandemic. I'm thinking of maybe healthcare workers and teachers. What can someone do to take care of themselves when they might be giving a lot to support others around them?
Yeah, I try to be careful about really knowing when I've hit my limit. You know, sometimes I think those of us in these professions, we want so much to help people all the time, but we do face burnout and we can get overwhelmed by it. And so just kind of knowing when I'm reaching that place and to step back a little bit. I have a lot of great friends, therapist colleagues that I'll talk to and kind of be able to work through how I'm feeling or what kind of support I might need. I love meditation. I know that can be eye-rolling for some people, or it can sound arduous or time-consuming, but even just, you know, 5 minutes of sitting and just taking some slow, even deep breaths with your eyes closed just kind of can really offer a nice reset. And it's so simple. It's something we can do anywhere, anytime.
That is Claire Bidwell Smith. The book is Conscious Grieving, A Transformative Approach to Healing from Loss. Claire, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Crane's Cleveland Business this month named Outstanding Octogenarians and Nonagenarians in its annual 8 over 80 awards. We're ending our series with the oldest honoree and the one only one in her 90s, Joan Southgate, who has had a fascinating life working to share the history of people who escaped American slavery and preserved Ohio's role in the abolitionist movement. We want to note that Joan has a vocal condition that makes it a little hard to understand at times. You'll also hear from Restore Cleveland Hope board member Jean Vanetta in this conversation. Joan Southgate, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
It's good to be here.
I want to say congratulations on the honor. And I was wondering, what was your reaction to being named one of Crane's 8 over 80 honorees?
Well, this year has kind of taken my breath away over so many things, but I was just ecstatic. And I'm well over 80. I'm 95.
Wow. And I hear the oldest honoree that was honored, but you all stand at a high level to us. So again, congratulations. So let's talk about your upbringing. You were born in 1929.
Yes.
In Syracuse, New York.
Yes.
And you said in your Crane's profile that your family would often talk about abolitionist Harriet Tubman, who ended up settling close by in central New York. So what influence did Harriet Tubman's story have on you growing up?
Well, the fact is that Syracuse is like 28 miles from Auburn, where she, after she finished all of her work with the Underground Railroad, and she settled a home for elderly colored people in Auburn. My mother is from Auburn, New York, so she knew Harriet Tubman personally.
So your mother was a child.
Yes.
And knew of Harriet Tubman, the adult.
Yes. So my mother tells a story that I remember and love about the children feeling protective of this old special woman. And she had narcolepsy. That's not the name back then. Or she would fall asleep in her carriage, and the children would line up on the curbside just to sort of make sure everything was all right until she woke up.
Oh, wow. That's an incredible story.
It is.
I would never have guessed what a personal connection you have to someone that obviously the kids in Auburn knew or had been taught was a treasure. So how did you eventually end up in Cleveland?
So I came to Cleveland for graduate school to Case Western Reserve. I'm a social worker in my master's degree. I was from Case.
And that was in the 1950s?
Yes.
And you worked as a social worker for 30 years. What made you want to get into the field of helping people in your community?
Yes, it's probably spirit. was probably how I was raised. That's who we were. I say 1929, the Great Depression, and I can even remember my mother, not because we had a lot, but just because this is what you do, feeding some of the bums, the tramps that would come through on the train.
It's just another thing that we were taught to do.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about this. Years after being a social worker, you embark on truly an incredible journey. At 74 years old in the early 2000s, you walked more than 500 miles across Ohio and into Canada, highlighting those people who had been slaves in America and wanted to escape to freedom in the North. So how did this idea come to you? And what did people think of the idea at the time?
The idea came to me while I was doing one of those let's get healthy walks. I thought of those people, families, people with children, people carrying babies, and no signposts, no real direction except the North Star.
Yeah. Wow. So you were thinking of those people who, like you said, no lights, no signposts,
no.
A sense of a direction of going north,
yes,
and fleeing for their lives and fleeing for the freedom of themselves and their loved ones.
Yes. Yes. And escaping the cruelty of slavery.
Escaping the cruelty of slavery. Now, did you feel that by doing this walk, you wanted to experience a little bit of what at least the physical difficulty was, or was it more just to honor them?
It was mostly to honor them. I somehow could think of them in a personal sense because it was many families, and I knew that it involved children and men, women, fathers, mothers.
The dads, the moms, yeah, the children having to make that trek and the fear the kids must have felt. I'm wondering, what were some of the special moments of that walk?
Let's see. I often think of the children.
The children.
Well, I think of a high school young man who said, that I was talking at the high school, asked me specifically about the walk. And I said, well, I've already done it. And his response was, dang.
The high school kid was impressed,
because,
right?
Yeah, because it was still afternoon, morning.
Wow.
And so that I'd already been out on my 10 miles.
And is that how
day.
Is that how you broke it up? You did 10 miles a day? Joan, will you tell me about the reactions you got from some of the children about what they would take with them if they were to make the same trek that those who were escaping slavery made to get to Canada?
I loved all the different schools that I was in, but what stands out is one visit to a school, and it was second graders. So there they are in the auditorium. And I'm asking them, so how would we begin the walk if we were freedom seekers? What would we need? And there are all kinds of answers. Blankets, food, something for the babies, if we're carrying the babies. And what stands out and still gives me chills is this one little girl, little blonde Helen, and she very quietly, 7 years old, said they would have to take their hope.
Wow.
Wow.
A second grader saying they'd have to.
Grade.
And it's almost like she understood, because that's what all those families needed was courage and hope.
Oh, she voiced it. The children had wonderful ideas, but
she understood.
That was a joy, the children and the diversity.
So sharing that with all walks of people, sharing your walk with all walks of people, that's truly impressive and warms the heart. So I know that you were able to save Joan a home that was instrumental for freedom seekers. And that started the organization Restore Cleveland Hope. And Jean Van Etta, you're in studio with us as well, a board member for this organization. So tell us a little bit about saving this home and why it was so important.
Well, Ohio was so instrumental in the Underground Railroad, and a lot of people don't know that, even people who live in the state. There were more trails and routes on the Underground Railroad through the state of Ohio than any other state, maybe all the other states put together.
Wow.
Probably 40% of the people who were able to escape from being enslaved came through Ohio. As you look at the geography, there's Kentucky and Virginia, what's now West Virginia, on the Ohio River. People could go across that river. And then, of course, there's Lake Erie. They could cross Lake Erie and get to real freedom in Canada. So a lot of people came across and came up and ended up in Hope. And all along the lake, people were escaping across the lake. But this house was built partly before the Civil War, the back part of it, which is now a Underground Railroad Interpretive Center, that we tell the story of what happened in northern Ohio and also parts of other parts of Ohio, because it's a complete piece. People were coming from the south and coming north, and they didn't have Harriet Tubman just to guide them here. Sure. She was never in Ohio. They had the North Star, and they had their own wits and their own sense of needing to escape. There were all kinds of abolitionists along the way. If you came across the Ohio River, John Parker was there in Ripley, Ohio, which is where Joan started her walk because of that. And he saved hundreds of people. He had his own business during the day, and at night he would work all night of pulling people across the river. He was black. Mm-hmm. That's true. And a lot of people have this concept that if you're an abolitionist, you're probably a white savior. But the fact is, it was a very multiracial experience.
And a lot of black people saving their own community members.
Absolutely, yes.
Yep. From enslavement.
And a lot of the people whose stories we tell are African-American people who were amazing achievers. Some people were escaping through Ohio and decided to stay and make it better here. John Malvin was one of those people. He was a free man who came here, thought he was going to go to Canada, ended up staying, and he ended up changing laws and starting schools in the state of Ohio for black children that didn't exist before. So there are a lot of fairly heroic people that nobody has ever heard of before. And we tell all those stories at this house now that's turned into a resource center. And we're there open every Saturday from noon to 4 o'clock for free tours.
Of the Cozad Bates House.
Of the Cozad Bates House. We can also do special tours at other times. You just have to contact us.
And again, why was the Cozad Bates House specifically one that Joan wanted to save?
Well, it was built in three sections. And the back section, where we have the Interpretive Center, was built in 1853, before the Civil War. So it's the only one left. Of course, there was a whole lot of things going on before the Civil War, and everything else has been turned over. The Cozad family actually donated a lot of land to Case Western Reserve, to where Severance Hall is now. They were very interested in education. But this was historic. I mean, this house is very historic, and it carries a history that was being lost. And it was really important to us to save that history.
So, Joan, you were instrumental in that. Again, you wrote a book about your 519-mile Underground Railroad walk called In Their Path. And I am wondering, in speaking about your extraordinary contributions, how would you tell younger people who hear your story about how they can be extraordinary in their lives as well?
I think the most important part is being kind, paying attention to what's going on, and knowing that what you did do personally, the stories you hear, the stories you pass along, even as a young person, are important. Takes me back to my childhood, where I grew up in Syracuse, New York, during the Great Depression, and in a family and neighborhood where my friends were Black and White, Jewish and Christian, and so diversity and this coming together has always been a part of my life, and it's something that children need to feel, learn, and pass on with to each other.
So be kind, pay attention, and for you, really understanding that importance of diversity and yes. having a community
yes.
that's
yes.
that's unified, even if it has many different faces.
Yes, many different faces.
Well, Joan Southgate, I appreciate you and having met you and all the things that you've done, truly some extraordinary things. So thank you for coming into the studio. And Jean Vanetta, thanks for coming in the studio and speaking with us as well.
Thank you so much. This was great.
It was an honor to speak with Joan Southgate, 95-year-old founder of Restore Cleveland Hope, one of this year's Crane's 8 over 80 honorees. Now, tomorrow on the show, we'll chat with the president and CEO, Bethia Burke, of the Fund for Our Economic Future and their latest green economy guide for area businesses. We are going to go back on the road for the Sound of Ideas community tour. That's happening May 9th at 6 p.m. We're going to talk about power and the intersection of wealth. Find details and register for the event at ideastream.org/SOI. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for listening. I'll speak with you again tomorrow.